Yo, Nicole.
Hey, Rolando.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
It depends on what age. At some ages, I wanted to be a doctor. At some ages, I wanted to be a bus driver. At other, that's true. At other ages,
I wanted
to be
a bus driver.
Yes.
Okay. So many questions. And maybe if we have time in this podcast, we'll get to it.
Yeah, some other time. And then a filmmaker. And, you know, now I just want to be happy. What about you?
So there was a point in my life when I was younger, mm-hmm. when I wanted to be a con artist.
Is this true?
This is very true. It's actually inspired when I saw the movie Heartbreakers.
Okay.
With Sigourney Weaver and Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Yes.
And I did the whole idea of this lifestyle of scamming people out of money, uh-huh. specifically rich people.
Robin Hooding them, yeah.
Well, is it Robin Hood if I wanted to keep the money for myself? I don't think so.
Oh, true.
Yeah, I'm not Bernie Sanders here. I'm not redistributing wealth.
Well, if you're needy, then you're giving to the needy.
Yes, that's true. I most certainly needed it. I wanted to be a con artist, which is the theme of today's episode.
Yeah.
Because today we'll be talking about three movies that all deal with two con artists. Mm-hmm. One experienced professional con artist and then the novice con artist. And I feel like I relate the most obviously with the novice because I don't know how to scam people, but I want to learn.
Mm.
And I'm looking for that con artist who will help me learn.
True.
So that's what we'll be talking about today. I'm Rolando.
And I'm Nicole.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast.
About
unoriginality.
Let's go to Portofino.
Oh, shoot. Next stop, Portofino. Well, actually, no. Before we get off on our stop, as we are on a train here in our heads, we're covering Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, The Hustle, and people don't know this, but there was actually a first film called Bedtime Story. Did you know that?
Yeah. No, I didn't know that. I've never heard of either of these three movies.
Mm-hmm.
So even The Hustle, I didn't know was coming out.
Oh, wow.
Or what it was about. I knew that Anne Hathaway was in a movie with Rebel Wilson, but I didn't know the premise. I didn't know the concept.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, so Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, I actually, because I don't know if you know this, but it was turned into a musical in like the early 2000s.
Oh, I actually saw that in my research. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went to go see it. It's a great musical.
Is it
a great musical. Oh, yeah. Okay. And then I saw the film after I saw the musical and I quite enjoyed the film.
So you saw the musical first?
Yes.
Oh, that's how old is the musical?
It came out in 2005.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I guess at this age it's 14 years old. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know.
I'm not gonna think about that too much.
You can't dwell on that.
Yeah, I can't dwell. Yeah.
Life happens.
I mean, I threw out my back again. I think there was another episode on this podcast where I threw out my back.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So
the audience understands how old you're getting. I get it. I'm so youthful at heart, physically, mentally.
Yeah. So these movies, they're all about con artists, like Rolando said in our cold open, and they're about two of them in the Mediterranean era. In the Mediterranean area, I should say.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's a Mediterranean era. The Greek era?
They're in the fictional town of Beaumont-sur-Mer, which is named after Beaulieu-sur-Mer, which is a real town between Nice, France, and Monaco.
Mm-hmm. On the French Riviera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they both competing for this property. One is, you know, erudite, very suave, very, I guess, what's a good word for him?
Pompous.
And one is a little bit more reckless, arrogant.
American. I think that's also very important for the script.
Why, this is true.
And usually an American and a European.
And they make a bet against each other as to who can stay in this particular era, Beaumont-sur-Mer, and they place a bet on a person.
There is a reveal at the end, but only in Dirty Rotten Scoundrel and on. She's the mark. She's like, there's always a mark, someone who they are going to target to con, and usually this person is very aw shucks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, usually, yes. All right, so let's do some history and let's go back to the very first iteration of this film.
Yeah, when did this original one come out?
1964, Bedtime Story.
In
if you've been listening to this podcast, we've covered other films in 1964.
Have we?
Mary Poppins came out in 1964. Oh. And like I said in that, you know, that year, the Beatles made Hard Day's Night, Elvis made Viva Las Vegas. Best picture of the year was My Fair Lady. Who gives? Mary Poppins came out, and so did this film, Bedtime Story.
And did Bedtime Stories do well in the Oscars?
No. I think that Bedtime Story has been generally forgotten.
It's been so forgotten that I couldn't find it streaming anywhere. You just had to go on YouTube and find some bootleg version of it.
Bootleg, yeah. And the fact that nobody's taking it down proves that nobody cares.
Yeah, apparently.
So this film was directed by a filmmaker named Ralph Levy, a television director of like real, real success. Jack Benny, I Love Lucy, Honeymooners, all this stuff. And he only directed two films, though. This and a Doris Day picture a couple years later called Do Not Disturb. And his success did not transfer into movies, unfortunately.
Oh.
And there's three major stars in it. The first is David Niven. And his character's name is Lawrence Jameson. And he is played by, in this film, David Niven.
Do I know David Niven from anything? Our audience know him from anything?
If this dear audience has seen a film called Around the World in 80 Days.
Oh, he was. I haven't seen the movie, but I know it.
Phineas Fogg. And he was in Casino Royale. He actually played James Bond in that film. This was a comedy.
Yes. Casino Royale is not canon. It's not part of the James Bond series, mm-hmm. but it is based off of the original book.
It is.
But it was a comedy.
In the 60s. That was making fun of the James Bond phenomenon in the 60s.
Yes.
And also, interestingly enough, he was also in The Pink Panther, and then he was in a film called Murder by Death that parodied detective movies. But so he's always in these kind of like heist con artist movies. Mm-hmm. Like David Niven, he's just really good at that. He's either playing, you know, a spy, or he's playing a detective, or he's playing a con artist. Like, he's just really good at that role. Yeah, he got typecasted.
Because he looks so international.
Yes, that too.
So mysterious.
So worldly, so cultural. And this arrogant American is named Freddie Benson. And in this film, he's played by Marlon Brando.
Yeah, Marlon Brando.
I'm afraid I'm a bit naive when it comes to the weaker sex.
The weaker sex? Remember this, it takes six men to carry a guy that was brave. It takes one woman to put him there.
Marlon Brando.
Sploosh.
10 years after On the Waterfront, and boy, has time aged him by that time.
Yeah.
Just as his boyish good looks have definitely faded.
He's still handsome, though.
Still handsome. But yeah. And then the role, their target, the kind of aw shucks gal, Janet Walker, is played in this film by Shirley Jones, who you might know from the Partridge Family.
Oh.
Okay. Or you might not know from the Partridge Family.
I know.
Butterless. And Eddie might know.
I know from the Partridge.
Hi, Eddie Z.
Now? You saying hello to me?
Now we're saying hello to you.
Hey, Eddie.
Very shady. Very shady.
I'm sorry. Bedtime Story was a moderate success, you know. Generally forgotten film. But I think the script is very good.
The script is pretty good. It's obviously good because it was picked up two more times.
Yes, and for a musical. And let me just tell you that the script for Bedtime Story is pretty much the basis, and at least the first half is beat by beat what the next two films will be.
Yeah, I would say the first two acts.
Yes.
Yeah, the final act is where it's different from the next two that would follow.
Yes. I think that Marlon Brando and David Niven are great actors, but they don't necessarily have what I consider the chemistry nor the comedy chops to make this a scream of a film.
I actually agree with you.
Yeah.
Has Marlon Brando been in any comedies?
I mean, he was in Guys and Dolls in 1955.
I don't know that movie.
You don't know Guys and Dolls?
Mm-mm.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck if you've ever been a lady to be... he was in that.
All right, so he was in a romantic comedy musical, but not in an actual comedy. I don't know much about Marlon Brando. I know like his major hits, but I don't know.
Other than that, that's like one of the only ones I can think of.
Interesting. So he actually, to be honest though, he wasn't bad.
He wasn't bad, no.
I actually think he... Maybe he's kind of playing that swarmy American that I could relate, because he is, you know, Stanley Kowalski. Whatever. Tomato, tomato.
Stala. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's it's him. Just easy to see him playing that kind of like that, not sleazy, not that Stanley was sleazy, but yeah, I don't know. Oh, he did rape someone, but.
He was terrible, yeah.
He was a terrible human being. But you know what I mean? Like, he was able to take that terribleness and kind of turn it into something a little charming.
Mm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And because that's the character, Freddy, right?
Freddie Benson.
Freddie had that charm. Mm-hmm. He's always able to just woo all these women, you know, to drop panties. Because it's implied, right? He bangs all these chicks. He fucks.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And that's why I think they also casted him. Because
women were ready to drop panty for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
He was still pretty much a sex symbol. Mm-hmm. I thought the way that the film began was also really nice. This one they did more of like a narration. They like someone was telling you a story.
It was a bedtime story.
Yes, exactly.
Not a bedtime story I would tell my child, but apparently that's what this is. It's interesting. It starts off that way. It doesn't end that way.
It doesn't. It loses that.
Yeah, it's just like, it's the first, like, it's the beginning and that's it. It goes away.
It doesn't, no pun intended, but it doesn't bookmark itself.
Right. And I think that's where also the title comes from, right? It's a bedtime story.
Yes.
And yeah, it doesn't come. This is probably why the movie doesn't do well.
Yeah, because it like, kind of loses just like,
what
itself.
The fuck is a bedtime story? There's nothing bedtime here. Unless he's talking about bedding all these women, but that's a little smart for that age.
Well, that's the thing, too. So when I was watching this film, I thought about it because this is 1964. And, you know, as I said in other episodes of the podcast, Hollywood was still under the code.
Mm-hmm.
But it was only three years later would the code be lifted. So films were really pushing that envelope.
Okay.
And there were ways that this film was like not abiding by the code, like more obvious sex jokes and whatnot. But at the same time, it really was kind of like not pushing it enough. For 1964, like there were films that were really pushing it.
Right.
That's why the code dissolved practically by
1967. We didn't go over the script, but like,
We did the basic storyline.
But it's important to know that during the bet, they're trying to figure out how to
steal the money from her,
how to con this woman.
Mm-hmm.
So in all the iterations, the novice con artist always decides to have a disability of some sort.
Yes.
And he ends up getting the attention of the mark. However, to combat this, the experienced one always has one of his accomplices eavesdrop.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, try to like beat him to that story. So in this version, you have Marlon Brando, who's a soldier who cannot who can't walk, so he plays the experienced con artist plays a doctor who can cure him.
Yes.
And that's kind of how this becomes almost a weird, it's not a love triangle per se, right? Because I never got the feeling that like Lawrence wasn't necessarily interested romantically in the lead actress. It was more like he was just like cock blocking.
Yes, basically. Yes, purposely. Yeah,
yeah.
And messing up his story and like one upping him.
Exactly.
But in every iteration too, the disabled person usually tugs on the heartstrings of the target.
Right. Because he's younger and more handsome.
Yes. And particularly in this version, like they really try and make it seem like these two people are genuinely falling in love.
Right. How did you feel about that? How did you feel about that? Because I have a follow-up question.
So this actually goes back to my like really upset at the fact that they didn't push enough boundaries, because I feel like that ending, and I don't know if I should spoil it or anything.
You might as well spoil it. It's from 1956.
64. but I feel like it kind of, you know, was like, oh, audiences will only accept that it's like a happy ending and that everybody is okay and that she doesn't get played anyway. So like in this film, Marlon Brando gives up being a con artist and the bet is off and he marries Janet and they fall in love. And this woman lives the rest of her life not knowing that she was fucking fooled by this guy, apparently.
She learned that the other guy was also a con artist, but that Marlon Brando was a con artist.
And so they get away with it and everyone lives in quotations happily ever after.
Right.
And back to the implied sex scene. Like she says, he's pretending that he's learned to walk. So she's like, come to me.
Yeah, because his disability doesn't come from a physical thing. It's always
it's always in their heads.
Emotional. And that's why Lawrence always, at least the other doctor, always plays a psychiatrist of some sort.
Yes, that fucks with him.
Right.
Because it's all in his head anyway. So when they embrace, it cuts to David Niven cheersing with a bunch of people. So cheers, right?
Yeah, but the message there, because his accomplice asks him, is just like, well, who's happier, you or the other guy? And he's just like, well, the other guy's happier because he has something that like I'll probably never have, which is love and marriage, right? It turned into this weird message of like,
it really does,
like, this pro-marriage, like this is what it takes to be really happy.
That's at the end of the film, you pretty much realize that be a con artist in Beaumont-sur-Mer on the Mediterranean, but you'll never be as happy as when you go back home to Biloxi or whatever you go and get married.
But it's also weird because immediately after that line, he's just like, but I'm going to go enjoy it anyway. Then he goes off to have fun.
Yeah, true. So like it kind of like almost does, the movie doesn't almost understand itself because like this guy goes and continues this life and this one doesn't. And mm-hmm. that's it. Like yeah. what is there to even get from it?
Right.
And like nobody gets comeuppance. This poor woman just victimized the whole film.
Yeah.
And lied to and like doesn't know the truth about anything. And like really, I thought wasn't dished out enough. You know, Shirley Jones is a really good actress. And yet I just thought she was wallpaper for Marlon Brando and David Niven for most of the time.
I would argue that that will happen in all two other iterations of this film.
Oh, interesting. Okay. There might be one that does it a little better.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that one because I think it's the same one.
So yeah, so it kind of implies it doesn't really, and then it falls short. You know, it's just like it reminds me of other films that you know that there was this film that came out in the 40s that was about a man who was slowly trying to kill his wife, but then at the end it's like, I wasn't trying to kill you, I was actually trying to save you, and it was like terrible.
What?
And they had to reshoot that ending because the studio heads were like, no, he can't end up killing her. So sometimes when I watch these old films, I'm like, did they end it this way because the studio commanded them to?
Like superhero movies with studio interventions.
Yes.
Okay.
Got like, you. So bedtime story.
I'm telling it to how the audience will probably understand it yes. because like no one fucking knows of anything before the 80s.
But anyway, so I just wonder if that ending was commanded by the studio or whether or not the scriptwriter intended it the entire time. Unfortunately, because the film is not very well known and well received, there's not a lot of information available. Unless I somehow find a book by Ralph Levy and I pick it up and I read it and I find out about it. But I don't think Ralph Levy ever had a book, nor was a book ever written about this man, the director.
I think they really focus also a lot here with Freddie.
They do.
Also the fact that he was actually in the military.
Yes, that's and he's the American.
Here, right? He's an ex, he's not an ex, he's actually currently serving in Germany, right? That's where the movie starts off. And he gets dismissed, though, because he banged his commanding officer's daughter. And in order to avoid a scandal, they dismiss him.
Yeah.
Right? But he wanted out. He wanted to bang all these women in yeah. Germany and con them. And what did you think of his cons?
Like the first one where he's like, oh, I grew up in this house. And
yeah.
everything reminds me, even the necklace on you and yeah. stuff. Yeah, I mean, like, as 2019 mentality, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? But I guess that worked back in the day.
I was thinking about it. It the reason it works is obviously because the internet didn't exist and you can't Google things, right?
So yeah. like
it was funny watching him take a Polaroid of the house as soon as she got in. And then like he just like takes some dirt and then he just like scrubs it a little. He's just like, oh, look, my grandmama, she gave me this photo of the house.
True.
This is the house. Oh, my gosh. Wow. And she's like, come feel how soft the bed is. He's like, yeah. no way is it soft. And then they go to bed anyway.
True.
It's just like, what the, like, girlfriend.
And, you know, I mean, this was during or right before like the second wave of feminism.
Uh-huh.
You know, so women just thought and were told, I mean, I'm not saying anyone is necessarily directly told, but our media and our culture and our society helps tell us things. So in the 60s, women were kind of getting these mixed messages and they were like, well, you can work, but you're still inferior.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So I guess I understand that that was the time frame in which it was made. So that's why a lot of these women just kind of sucked.
Interesting you should bring that up, because gender politics actually doesn't play that much of a role in this film. I think no. it will later on.
It definitely
in other films,
will.
But
me applying it.
It's a little interesting. It's introduced a little bit when the two characters meet for the first time on the train, right?
Mm.
Where Marlon Brando's character automatically assumes that Lawrence is married. And he's just like, oh, you're married. He talks disparagingly about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just find out later on that he will end up getting married, right? Like his comeuppance.
Yeah.
I guess you would say.
Yeah.
But yeah, there wasn't a lot of depth in this film. With that said, I mean, what did you think of this one then?
Of Bedtime Story?
Yeah.
I did think that there was a little bit more like favoritism towards the Marlon Brando character, like
right.
you had brought up. And I thought it was interesting, too, because he's an American and he's a military man and he's kind of like an quote unquote average Joe. And America loves averageness.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and he gets what he wants and he gets redeemed at the end and he doesn't. And it also he doesn't have to explain himself. He just gets what he wants
mm-hmm.
and he's validated.
Yeah.
And like I was like snore fest for that just yeah. because I don't like seeing that sometimes.
Right. Right.
Most of the time.
I agree.
But other than that, I thought it was crazy how much of it was used in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, how much of it actually, in terms of a script, works and how strong the script was.
Agreed.
I just thought that the the approach wasn't that great. Mm-hmm. The direction and everything, you know, like that's why they remade it. And I think ended up making it better. What about you?
I enjoyed Dirty Rotten Scoundrels a lot. And that was actually the first one I saw out of the three.
Yeah.
Which I think is an excellent segue to talk about Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Bam. You know who directed this film?
Who directed it?
This film was directed by Frank Oz. Frank Oz.
Why do I know that name? I feel like I should know that name.
You should know that name. He also directed Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, yes.
He also, I love that movie. Yeah, he's a great director. He's also a Muppet performer who originated the roles of Sam Eagle, Fozzie Bear, Animal, and Miss Piggy.
Ugh, all of those were whack.
No.
Excuse me.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Miss Piggy?
Miss Piggy?
Oh, I was actually talking about Sam the Eagle.
And Sam Bear. Eagle is great. And Fozzie's, all of his Muppets are great. I'm not a fan of Fozzie Bear. Why?
I don't know.
He's so fragile and insecure, and he just wants to be funny and loved.
I love that he's trying to be a comedian.
Yeah, and he's not good. He's just not good at it. It's so endearing.
But no, Miss Piggy for sure is queen.
Yeah, Miss Piggy's life.
Miss Piggy is like everything.
And he's Yoda.
Oh, he's Yoda too? Oh.
Frank Oz is pretty fantastic. He's as important as Jim Henson is. And so, yeah, so he actually, the first film he directed was Muppets Take Manhattan. And then he's like, I want to be a filmmaker. And then he made Little Shop of Horrors. And then he made Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. That's pretty impressive.
That is pretty impressive, yes.
Yeah.
Although I wish there were more puppets now in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yeah. Well, I think he was trying to get away from that.
The puppets, to be honest.
Not any, actually. And they're Muppets.
What did I say?
Puppets.
Please.
No. Okay. Right. They're different. It's because they're a mix between marionette and puppets, so they're Muppets.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There you go.
Wow. All this random knowledge you're throwing at me today. Love it.
Knowledge queen.
So, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, 1988, the year I was born.
Oh. Yeah.
And Rain Man won Best Picture that year. Steve Martin, and this is Freddie Benson in this one. And Michael Caine is Lawrence Jameson in this one. And Glenn Headley, she was in a lot more films from back in the day. She was also in Dick Tracy in 1990. She was in Mr. Holland's Opus.
Who was she in Dick Tracy? She must have been like his assistant.
No, she was Tess.
Who's Tess?
The girl that Dick Tracy was obsessed with.
That was Madonna.
No, Madonna wanted to bang him, but he was in love with Tess. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Steve Martin. So where does this fall in Steve Martin's career of movies?
Okay, so I'm actually a really big Steve Martin fan. I think he's hysterical.
Yeah, I think he's very underappreciated by our generation, to be honest.
I think so, too, because I think that his humor is just like, I don't know, I just really love his humor. I'm not even going to get into that. So this was now when he was just primarily making films. He wasn't doing stand-up anymore, and he kind of went over from that, like, jackassy jerk character that he played in the 70s, and now he was starting to form his wonderful snob thing. And I just love that persona of his. So the year before, 87, he made Roxanne. The next year, he made Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Okay. So this is a really great time for Steve Martin.
And where does Father of the Bride fall?
In 1991.
Oh, that's
so
90s.
a couple years later.
I thought it was 80s. Okay.
Wow. Yeah, just a couple years later, which is also a remake.
Yes, that I know.
I wonder if they're going to remake it again, then we could do it.
You know it's due?
It's due. You're right. It is due. And Michael Caine, he made Hannah and Her Sisters in 1986, which he won the Academy Award for.
Uh-huh. And he was also Alfred in the Batman Nolan series.
Many years later, yes.
You know what? He still looks just as old then as he does now.
Yeah, he's going to look perpetually old.
I think he has that just distinguishedness about him.
You like know? Morgan Freeman.
Like, yeah, that's older him. Man, distinguished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he was going to be in... as Ebenezer Scrooge in A Muppet Christmas Carol only a few years later.
Also directed by Ed Knox.
Ed. Serious?
Ed.
Frank Oz.
Frank Oz. What?
Ed Knox? Where do you get these names from?
Oh my gosh. That's the title of the episode. Directed by Ed Knox. No, Brian Henson directed Muppet Christmas Carol.
Oh, okay.
But so anyway. Glenn Headley, I already said what she's in. So this is a really good time for everybody.
Yes.
And yeah. Plots essentially the same, at least the first half.
The first two acts, I would say, is the same. With the big difference is that Freddie, are they still the same names that I don't remember?
Freddie and Lawrence, yeah.
Okay, so I could not. It's for me, I never learned the characters' names usually, especially when they're a big name actor. Mm-hmm. So Steve Martin, I know Steve Martin. It's like, this is Steve Martin. Steve Martin and Michael Caine. So going forward, I will only refer to them probably as Steve Martin and Michael Caine. Sorry, yeah. Guys. It's just how I do.
It's cool.
But to get to my point, Steve Martin, he was not military.
No.
He was just a vagabond.
Yes. And then he adapted that when he became the crippled persona that he did.
I don't think we're allowed to say cripple.
When he became the handicapped person.
Disabled.
Really?
I don't know.
Whatever.
Okay. Don't offend people, Nicole. Check your privilege. You can walk. Steve Martin could not. Or he was faking it at least. All right. It's very complicated, guys.
Yeah. Just watch the movies. So, other than that, it's pretty much the same. You know, they're both competing to stay in this land, in the Beaumont-sur-Mer. And then they place a bet on Janet. In this one, she is the Colgate queen.
Yeah. Actually, I just realized we did skip a lot of the plot. Because that's like actually like literally the bet is like the middle of the film.
Mm-hmm.
The first act, like not even like the first act and a half, I guess, mm-hmm. is
really getting introducing.
Films, yeah, you're kind of seeing how both of these characters differ in terms of style.
Yes,
right. You have the experienced one who's more debonair. Is that a word?
Debonair. Yes.
Debonair. Shit. All right. Debonair.
It's either.
I hopefully. And then you have the novice who's a little more crass. He relies on kind of his looks, his charm,
yes,
to really get these cons. And basically what happens is Michael Caine's character, as in the other film, he sees this younger guy, this American, as a threat, and his plan of action is to get rid of him as fast as possible.
Yeah.
Send him off to another town. However, that doesn't work. So usually there'll be some set of actions that will get him arrested.
Yes.
And from when he gets arrested, Michael Caine's character will come in and then help con him. They con Steve Martin, for example, to mm-hmm. get him to leave the country and never come back. However, it is always on the flight back where Steve Martin's character discovers one of the previous marks and discovers, oh my God, I was just con. And he returns. And decides, like, I want this life. I want this. I deserve it. And he goes under the wing, begrudgingly, of the experienced guy.
Yes.
In this case, Michael Caine. And Michael Caine is doing this in order to try to gracefully push him out.
Yes.
And then usually when after learning, which is how we get Ruprecht,
mm-hmm.
We see there's usually a montage that features a series of scams that they're pulling together. And then at the end of that montage, they will split the commissions and Steve Martin, usually the novice one, won't get anything. And as a result, he gets all pissy. And that's how they go on to the bet and decide who's going to run this town.
Yes.
That's my summary of it. I think it's important because, you know, Ruprecht is important. Ruprecht was the montage here of like that leads up to the bet.
Yes.
So talk to people. What is Ruprecht?
So these people that Michael, the novice and the professional.
Uh-huh.
The professional is conning. They want to marry him. So they want to get a way that they can get some goods out of these women that they're conning, but not have to actually come through with the marriage and have the people be so genuinely turned off that they'll right. like run away in fear. So they come up with this character called Ruprecht, where it's his little brother who is just not all there.
He is definitely mentally disabled.
Yes.
In
a very extreme way.
I think it's implied, right? Because he's supposed to be royalty. And he's like inbred.
Yes.
That's the implication there.
Yeah.
So.
Don't worry, Ruprecht. We won't go anywhere without you.
And there was this one really gross joke where it's like, what did we do when our uncle came? And he like put a glove on.
Yes.
And
I remember that. That was filthy.
And he put like
Vaseline.
Vaseline on. And Vaseline. I was like,
so he puts on a glove and then he, it's like a big rubber glove and then he covers it with Vaseline. And then Michael Caine's like, no. Not that. You say thank you afterwards. It's just like, what?
Yeah, I was like, that was the first time I caught that. And I was like, holy shit.
You thank them after getting fisted?
Yeah. That was really
I didn't know this
crazy.
Was WeHo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Gay jokes.
They have really good chemistry, I thought.
I agree. I think they did have good chemistry. Mm-hmm. I think all right, so there's another important character that ends up coming.
Okay,
which is
so
the
Janet.
One that I like. I like her. However, I think but why do I like her? Why do I like her, Nicole? Tell
so
me.
If I were to guess, it might be why I do. Shirley Jones in the original film playing Janet, she was just a lovely girl. And you could see where Marlon Brando was saying, oh, you're actually pretty lovely, right? But the Janet in this one, played by Glenn Headley, had more humanity to her, and out of all of them, I'll say. And what I mean humanity is that you got to see, like, her react more to things and, like, actually some personality traits.
Yeah.
She's kind of gullible. She doesn't know any better. But she's really well-intentioned, very sweet.
She's very Pollyanna.
Pollyanna.
That's the word.
She's very Pollyanna.
Yes.
Cookie cutter almost. And there's more beats with both of them. Not only Steve Martin's character, like, really forcing her to fall in love with him, but, like, actual genuinely the two of them, like, getting along. Like, when she's like, oh, I had to come back. And he's like, you did? Like, he's like, I can't believe you came back for me. You know, like, almost like, wow, like, you are a genuine person. And then Michael Caine's character feeling the same way about her. And in this film, they established that the Michael Caine character sees her for who she is and falls for her.
That's okay. I wanted to ask you that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he fell in love with her?
Or was it more like
a paternal kind of, I kind of want to protect you from the world?
I would really, really hope it was more paternal. And obviously the character saw it that way,
it didn't seem romantic.
It was, you know, when he puts her on the plane and then he sees that she turns around and then he goes to her with his arms open. I don't know if, you know, my father figure would run to me like that.
Hug you?
Did that look like arms wide open for a hug or arms wide open for a certain type of embrace?
I don't know. I don't think.
What do you think, Eddie?
Well, actually, using that word embrace indicates
a hug,
a level of intimacy,
a level of romantic inclined intimacy, I'll say.
Did you ever see the movie Lost in Translation?
Of course.
All right. So you remember that ending where they're in the airport and they Scarlett Johansson and Bill Murray's character, they have that embrace. It ends with a kiss, so, right?
Mm-hmm.
This one didn't end with a kiss, so this could be what's clouding my judgment. I don't feel like his character ever crossed that line. I think, I interpreted this very much as paternal. He cares for her because it's just like, oh, you're a good person. You don't deserve what we're doing to you. Because he has a code. Michael Caine's character has a code in this film.
But that's also what they're implying at, is that this is the first girl that really, really broke that and really got to him, really penetrated his cold, icy exterior his code.
So you think, you suspect it was a little romantic.
I do. I suspect that he was such a gentleman that he was never going to act on it until that moment he thought he was going to embrace her. But other than that, the paternal thing, I don't think it's there. Mm-hmm. But I think it's hinted at well enough that it could go either way, which is nice and refreshing. But yeah, so the end, though, is very different in this one from the original Bedtime Story.
In the original one, they end up happily ever after together. Yes. The novice con artist and then the girl that they were going to con.
Mm-hmm.
In this one, did they bang? They didn't bang. No, I take it back. They didn't bang.
They didn't.
Yeah.
This one was more into, like, implying that they were about to.
Yeah. And there's a reason for that.
Yes.
There's a big implication. There's a scene where, like, even they're retelling, like a passerby who saw, it's like, oh, she closed the door and closed the drapes. You know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're fucking guys. Yeah. And
this actually plays on cinematic expectations and language.
Right, because you saw, it's so interesting too. And I guess this goes with me not thinking it was more paternal,
mm-hmm.
right? Like it was like a heartbreak, but it didn't seem like a heartbreak, like, oh, like he got to her. It was like a heartbreak, like a father when he learns his daughter is no longer a virgin. That's what it felt like for me.
True.
There's like a heartbreak that happens. I can tell you, if I have a daughter, the moment I find out that she's not a virgin even she gives birth, I'm going to assume she's a Virgin Mary, obviously. These are my old Hispanic ways, guys. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But after that, right, the expectation was like, oh, Steve Martin and her are going to end up together.
Mm.
And if you had seen the original movie, you would expect that's where the movie's going to go. However, there is a big twist here. And that twist is
that the jackal that he thought was Steve Martin the whole time, he refers to Steve Martin's character as a jackal, was indeed Janet.
Yes.
And that's the nice thing about this film is that, you know, the original film, Bedtime Story, it was about con artists. But this film is a con artist itself. This film conned you into thinking certain things.
Yes.
And it used cinematic language and, you know, narrative storytellings to appropriately con you.
Yes.
And then at the end, like, they've been had, you as an audience member have been had. Unless, of course, you're a person who watches a lot of movies and in 2019 watching, you predicted it halfway through the film. But Because there's always that asshole who wants to be above the film and be like, oh, I saw it coming a mile away.
I mean, I kind of saw it coming.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen this movie ever before. But it was still like refreshing when it happened.
True. And I think in 1988, though, like before Ocean's 11, which is another film that like the cons con you and the film cons you. Like, I think people were more like, oh, wow. I hope so. I don't know. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was a mediocre success, I think.
Yeah.
And again, it's not a film that a lot of people know, unfortunately.
It's not. Yeah. Again, it's not like when you think of like when you think of Marlon Brando films, you don't think of Bedtime Story. When you think of Steve Martin films, I don't think a lot of people think of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
No, but I hope that changes because I think it's a very strong film.
I agree with you. I think it is a very strong film.
Yeah.
I think they're it's a wonderful film.
I think so, and I think the ending's great.
So yeah, so you would think that's the ending, that's how it ends, right? She cons them. So
but then the film actually ends right after, like a week later, 2 weeks later, you know, Steve Martin crashed at his villa for a little bit to recuperate after that. And then he's like, all right, well, I'm off. But then she comes back and she is doing this whole big con about a bunch of rich people looking to buy property, I suppose.
Yeah, realty.
And realty in Beaumont-sur-Mer. And she's playing this ridiculous, like, gaudy American character. It's just completely American. Different from who she was portraying to be.
Yeah.
And then while, you know, she sends the rest of them to have food in his villa.
Well, actually, before that, she this is, I think this is what made the movie so cute at the very end. It's like she's able to, you know, the guys are looking at her like in disbelief as she's returning back with all these people. And then she's just like, and these are Australians right here.
And she just throws them into
Michael Caine just breaks into an Australian accent. And right before Steve Martin, because she's like, and our friend here, he's a mute.
Yeah. So don't speak, please. So
to not speak, basically. And then together they decide, it's like, we're going to work. We're going to do these cons together.
Yep.
And they become like kind of like a big happy three-way.
Fellas, last year I made $3 million. But your 50,000 was the most fun.
And then, yeah, and then they all go off hand in hand. And it's actually, like, really cute.
It is. It's
and
a cute ending.
Yeah, you want it. It's like, oh, I wish you guys could cot be.
Yeah, I wish it was a Dirty Rotten Scoundrels too, and I could see some scans that they were together.
Right? Oh, yeah. No, if it came out in this, like, year, then we would definitely get a sequel. We'd get, like, five of them.
So, gender politics. I think gender politics in this film played a much more important role than the previous one. Because Steve Martin has more of, they both had two very differing codes, where Michael Caine's code was to like steal from rich women. He steals from rich women, and wait, now I'm confusing the two movies because I kind of saw them all simultaneously. Michael Caine, did he divvy up the money? He divvied up with his crew, but did he also have like a villa that he was also funding? Like all these people underground working for him, like, oh, the shoemaker. I think that might have been
Because he's like, you know, my gardens and my art that I buy.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So he.
Yes. Okay. Right. Yeah. It's about like kind of this lifestyle and stuff.
Yes.
That he's promoting and he's trying to teach him. It's just like, this is what I do with the money. I'm moving culture forward.
Yeah.
Right. And Steve Martin wants nothing to do with that. But they also have two very different point of views on women. Right. Where Steve Martin's character had like this interestingly feminist, anti-feminist idea, which was just like women should be treated equal and they should be easy targets as a result. That's kind of his mentality, right?
True. Well, he also says, I tell them what they want to hear if it gets me what I want.
Yes, he also had that. He had very opposing views.
Yes. Whereas like Michael Caine is very respectful and like chooses the people like on certain conditions and plays them he just chooses wisely. Steve Martin just attacks you.
Yeah.
And he plays on your emotions and what you want. And he'll like tug at your heartstrings and all this stuff to get what he wants.
Yeah.
And then he'll also bed you. So he also, in a weird way, he has no respect for you. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I say, let them give us money. Let's live off them for a while. That probably shocks a guy like you, right?
Well, it's rather a revolutionary thought. Do you really think it's possible?
Steve
Martin, I never realized he's kind of handsome.
Oh, he's pretty handsome.
I don't know, pretty handsome.
Is that an oxymoron? Pretty handsome.
Yeah, he's like you know what it is. He's like kind of cute. I think his character was just cute, and it's just like, okay, I can see why women fall for this.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, though, he's not. I mean, how much younger than Michael Caine do you think he is?
Oh, why? Because he has white hair.
I know he has white hair, but I think that's his look.
I'd probably say about 10, 15 years younger.
Yeah, it's not that much younger.
Not much. Yeah.
I think the Marlon Brando other character had a bigger age gap.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Actually, maybe not.
No, you don't think so?
I don't think so.
Oh, maybe Marlon Brando just looks younger.
Maybe. In my case, I think he actually looks older.
But... Well, older than his other movies, yeah.
Yeah, but they're, you know, in these first two films, it's always like an older, around-the-block person teaching like the young, arrogant one. Mm-hmm. But in The Hustle, it wasn't that.
No, it was not that.
And now I guess we should hustle our way into 2019 and talk about The Hustle.
We're going to do The Hustle.
Let's do it.
Do The Hustle. That's so corny. I can't believe we did that. I'm a badass woman. What's wrong with that?
So The Hustle.
The Hustle.
We just saw this film. It's fresh in our minds. We were taken aback by how much of a beat by beat it was a remake of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yes.
Crazy.
Up until the third act.
Up until the third act where they kind of switched things around. And then it's amazing how something can be such a beat by beat and yet still not have the same je ne sais pas.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
No.
Because that's the thing, like I don't even know what it is, the quality, the chemistry, like what is it? But and yet The Hustle doesn't have what Dirty Rotten Scoundrels had.
Okay.
In my opinion.
And you can't put your finger on it.
Yeah, because it's like it's beat by beat. They did everything except, you know, of course the jokes are a little different.
The jokes
and the
are
dynamics
very
are
different.
Yeah.
And I think there's also something that's importantly different. They are women.
That's
in this
the
one.
Thing. So it's actually pretty incredible how a couple years, different mindsets, reverse the sexes, and a film can completely change even though everything's practically the same.
Yes. This is not just the sex that was changing. Mm-hmm. They're also trying to, you also have to address the time period that we're living in.
Yes.
Right? So you have to update some of the scams. You're updating some of the hits, like your targets, right?
Yes.
I think that was all fine. So I guess right off the bat, I actually enjoyed this film a lot more than I thought I was going to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I laughed out loud way more than I thought I would.
But I think I know what you mean in which the Dirty Rotten Scoundrels has like a certain flair that this one doesn't. And I don't know what it is. To me, I think personally what it might have been, for at least for me, was it's over. I like Rebel Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
I think her physical comedy does not compare with Steve Martin's.
Yes.
And I think at certain points, you know how it was a beat by beat remake? It's almost trying to be, she's trying to be what Steve Martin was, but almost exaggerated.
I could see
and
that.
And it didn't work for me at times. Again, not to say, I actually enjoy Rebel Wilson.
Yes. But I also think she was Rebel Wilson exaggerated.
Yeah.
That's true. Rebel Wilson tends to exaggerate her performances.
I think that, like, especially in the train when they're in the same compartment and mm-hmm. just, like, after a while, she just was like, right, don't care, bye. You know, like, dismissing her and stuff. Like, almost to, like, that wasn't very funny because it was too exaggerated. I'm choosing a specific scene where it's just, like, a couple of jokes of that is good. Why does the whole banter have to be that way?
Right. I think, yeah, no, I agree with you there. I think that's for sure one of one of the more problematic scenes in the movie, actually. There was a scene where, and again, this is so many spoiler guys, I apologize.
Yeah.
But this is the podcast you signed up for.
Exactly. you better have signed up for
it. There's a scene where she is running, and then she has a slip, and then it was like a physical comedy moment, and then like the vase falls on her, right? And for me, that kind of took me a little bit out of it, because it's just like, oh, I don't need this scene. You're kind of building up on the story. Just keep going with the story. Don't give me all this like gag comedy.
You're right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's not to say, again, Rebel Wilson is a great physical comedian.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's just like the beat by beat. It just felt like she was trying to be Steve Martin, though, for me.
Yeah. I do think it's also giving into what people like of her.
Yeah, that's true.
Like stupid jokes, you know, like people like throwing a fart joke or throwing a pratfall or whatever, and people
or a
love
fat
it.
Girl joke
or a fat girl joke, and there are plenty of those.
Yeah.
And that's also kind of what they base her character around, is that the reason why she's a con artist is because she sees that men are shallow and that men are disappointed whenever they meet her. So she's like, that's why I'm gonna fucking rob your ass, because you fucking deserve it, because you minimize me.
And she's absolutely 100% right in doing so.
Yeah, I like that they use that.
Because
mm-hmm. I was like, how are they going to do this? Like, how are they going to manipulate it for men? Because men deserve to be taken advantage of more than women do.
whoa. I agree with you. Rich men, specifically.
Rich, yeah, and assholes. Because there are some moments where her comedy really works.
Yeah.
And that the moments of her work, like when she's telling the story about how she got blind, and then she's like, oh, and then I tried someone to scare me, but turns out it's not like hiccups or something.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah.
I thought that was so funny.
Her monologue there.
Yeah.
That was a good one.
It was really great, you know? So it's like, they're like, you're funny and what you do works, you know? And like, you can tell where it's her and it's like her doing what she does best, but then you can tell where it's like more forced or put on, and that's just unfortunate.
Yeah, Rebel was one of the producers for this movie.
Oh, she was?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, good for her.
So that can mean a lot of things.
Yes.
But
so she plays the Freddie Benson character, but in this one, her name is Penny. And she's not the American. But
yeah, she's Australian.
She's Australian. She's just, and there's no Americans in this one, actually, other than some of the targets. Wait, there is one American. I'm sorry.
Who?
In terms of the two con artists, there's no American. the target is American. American.
Yes, yes, yes. But the target was always American, all three of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and now the expert, right? The professional, the one who's older, more learned, cultural, is played by someone who is, I think, presumably the same age.
Yes. Well, I don't know. Anne Hathaway's got to be a little older.
Maybe, but like
Anne
the characters you could
what,
assume
in her 30s?
Are, she might be, yeah.
Rebel Wilson actually might be also in her 30s.
Yeah.
So I guess you're right. They
I don't
be
know.
The same age.
Anne Hathaway's got amazing skin, though, for her whatever age she is.
Call money.
Did you buy that her character with apparently learning, knowing four languages and, you know, being as rich and as cultural as she is, do you think someone her age is like likely to pull that off all by
in
themselves?
Her 30s?
30s,
I think it
yes.
was she was in her 30s. I think the answer for me would be yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't find that. You know why? Mm. Specifically a woman more so than a man.
Mm.
A woman would probably have the patience to actually and the dedication to do all the stuff that she has accomplished.
Okay.
Than a man would.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I wouldn't believe that it was like a hot 30-year-old guy who was just like, I know all this shit. I know wine. I know this thing.
True.
And that would seem much more fake. A woman who and maybe the other reason it might have been easier for me to believe this was because Anne Hathaway played Catwoman, and this is basically just a continuation of the Catwoman character. As far as I'm concerned, this is a sequel to Batman Returns.
He's been dying to make this connection
Batman,
since he saw the movie.
Do not belittle my joke here.
If it's a sequel to Batman Returns,
not Returns,
be Michelle
Pfeiffer.
The other one.
But, yeah. Batman,
The Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah. Relives. Shit. I want to get so much hate mail for this.
Oh, Tim, what is it? It's
The Dark Knight Rises.
The Dark Knight Rises. There we go.
Dark Knight Rises.
I just thought it was interesting because I always question to myself. It's like, oh my God, how'd you learn all these languages? How did you get all that? But that's, of course, applying too much reality to a fantasy.
She's also European.
And that's the thing. So when the film begins, she's pretending to be an American. She's also, you know,
she knocked out that American accent.
Yes, and she they give an ode to the Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, where her character's name was Janet, and she won a contest. So like she was being that character, but then it turns out that her character is British, or at least French. I don't know, one of them European.
She was European.
Yeah, she was European, and Anne Hathaway is pretty good at her accents.
Yeah, she is.
She does a lot. She does like four of them in this film.
Oh, I think more. Are we counting her?
She speaks
her Australian...
Dutch once. She does the. When did she do the Australian?
At
she
the
was,
end.
But she was mute.
Oh, you're right. She was a mute. I take that back. It was
you're
Rebel.
Confusing
who
the
is
other
Australian.
One. Yeah, it was Rebel. She spoke Dutch for once. She did some French. She did her English accent. And then she did her German accent on top with her American accent. So, you know, I think that she's a very talented actress.
Well, she's an Oscar-winning actress.
Yeah, who people hate.
Why? Yeah, thank you for saying that, because so many people do hate her. There's a thing called Hatha-hate, and I don't understand why. Like, why do we take America's Princess from The Princess Diaries and our Catwoman, and why do we hate her so much? Is it her smile?
I don't know what it is.
I love her smile.
One, it's easy to hate women, period.
Uh-huh.
But then there's something about certain white women that people love to hate. And I'm not saying that I'm one of these people, but like I've noticed it where it's like a certain really powerful, strong, independent, everyone loves her white woman you just want to shit on.
I guess. Like, when did the hate start? Was it before she hosted the Oscars or after?
I think it was around the Les Mis time when she won her Oscar. And
so that
was
right,
like really sad.
So that was.
It. That was after she hosted the Oscars.
And that's the other thing, right? How could you hate on her when she had to host the Oscars by herself when James Franco gave her nothing?
Well, yeah, because everyone was like, but James Franco was stoned and he's so cool, man. Like, ugh, snore.
Snore indeed. It's a fucking Oscars, man.
Yeah, and it's just like, James Franco's not cool.
And she picked up his slack.
Yeah.
I feel like she should be America's sweetheart, and she's not.
She's not. No,
she's constantly trying.
I don't know what it is. We should get somebody on here. Guys, if you hate Anne Hathaway, tell us why.
Yeah, Lee, for sure on our comments when we tell you on our social media pages later
on. We want to understand. But anyway, so people hate Anne Hathaway. I mean, I don't know if I could do all of those accents that well.
I couldn't.
Watching that film, I think she's a pretty good actress.
I could barely do a Boston accent if you guys heard our The Departed episode. Yeah.
What do men want?
Boobs.
No.
Back door. Front door. Pegging. Oh my God, threesome. What is it? What's the answer?
They want to be heroes. There's nothing more compelling to a man than a vulnerable woman.
Rebel Wilson, she's just herself in this movie, and yet Anne Hathaway's doing all the real acting, but of course everyone likes Rebel Wilson more because Rebel Wilson's just being herself, which I'm not saying like is a problem or anything. It's just interesting that...
Actually, I think Anne Hathaway killed it in this movie.
I thought
and
she did great
she
too.
Was...
And her outfits? Oh.
Yeah. Anne Hathaway, though. If you had a body like that, like you could pull any outfit.
Yeah, of course.
But what do you think of their chemistry?
I didn't really... think they had that much chemistry.
Interesting. I actually thought they worked together fine. Maybe it's interesting, right? Because this isn't the first heist movie that Anne Hathaway has been in.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess seeing
it's
her...
It's the second remake one she's been in.
Huh?
It's her second remake of a heist movie.
This is true, yeah. Mm-hmm. Ocean's 11, guys, also available on your podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Here, she was interacting with Rebel, but she was supposed to not like her.
Yeah.
Intentionally. So I don't know how much chemistry they're supposed to have.
True. Well, also, you know, in the other film, the one that their humanity is explored more is the Michael Caine, the professional.
Yes.
And that the target brings that out in him. And then you see this mutual respect form in between them.
Yes.
And this genuine kind of like almost love, whether it's paternal or whatever. And Freddie remains arrogant. But in this one, they reversed that.
Towards
the end. So what they did was that Penny is the one who actually builds this relationship with the target. The humanity comes through between the two of them. And they form this genuine love between each other, which turns into, I guess, physical love. And then, or sexual love, I should say. Sorry.
Wait, they fucked?
Well, at the end, she was like, right, if you ever fuck me over, I'm going to turn you down to sex once a year, once a day. Only in the morning. Remember that joke?
Remember that joke, but they didn't bang yet.
No, they didn't bang.
Pretty much like they were in love or something. I don't know, whatever.
It was implied that him and Anne Hathaway would have banged. Banged.
You would have or had?
That was the implication that they did, but then the twist at the end is that they didn't.
Yeah, and the film comes.
Like in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yes.
Yes.
So, but in this one, the one that kind of remains the same person, of the same personality, is Anne Hathaway. But she's cold and she's icy and she's kind of uptight. Or at least uptight in her own, like, up her own asshole.
Yeah, so that's, I think, where this movie kind of falters a little for me.
Yeah, they didn't give her any humanity.
Because by the end of it, where Steve Martin was kind of the bad guy in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels,
mm-hmm.
technically Rebel Wilson should have been, but they kind of gave her the humanity. Anne Hathaway kind of became like more of a bitch towards the end of it.
Yeah, she did.
And
they didn't redeem her at all.
There was very little to redeem her.
Yeah.
And they carried that all the way through the very ending where, you know, the three of them decided to con other people together,
mm-hmm.
where they made Anne Hathaway the mute because he was just like, shut up, bitch.
Yeah, because he didn't have that relationship with her.
Because he had half the hate.
Yeah. Well, you know, I liked that they changed it. I liked because they established why the Rebel Wilson character cons. So that here's a person who actually made her, saw her for her and like got through to her, right?
I thoroughly enjoyed that as well.
But it almost seems like they did that at the sacrifice of building up the Anne Hathaway character.
Which was a shame because she was such a strong performer that they should have found a way to salvage it. There was also, I think the third act kind of felt a little rushed.
It did, and that's the thing. This movie flies by. It's like an hour and a half and it flies by. Yeah. They miss a lot of beats in this one.
As the third act.
Yeah. Like, they don't have enough beats of Penny and the target Alex Sharp's character like having those genuine connections. I mean, you know, in both Bedtime Story and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, those scenes by the beach, they don't have that.
They were eating ice cream together, waffles, I think, Belgian waffles.
Yeah, but there was a couple of scenes like that in the other films, and in this film, there was one.
You're right.
So you need to build that. You can't just show it once and then, like, the audience needs to accept it.
You're right, because that was actually shorter than the montage they had of them scamming the rich men.
Yes.
Although I love that montage.
That was a good one.
That was a good montage, except... again, I'm going to say Rebel was no Ruprecht.
Yeah, the Hortense thing I thought was actually like, it was kind of uncomfortable in the theater because people like wanted to laugh, but they weren't laughing.
I think the second time, the second two scams, they were great. It was the first one where she's in the room in like the cage.
Yeah.
That's where I was just like,
oh. Yeah.
It felt rushed. Because in the Dirty Round Scoundrels, that scene lasts, they build that out. They don't build it out, but you know what I mean? They let it breathe.
Yeah.
They let you sit with that comedy. Here, like, Anne Hathaway announces that she's getting married, and like immediately Rebel starts flipping out and going crazy.
True.
Where if they had gone to Dirty Round Scoundrels, give it like an extra 3 minutes.
Well, they also, you don't really know what's wrong with the Hortense character. Like, they didn't even, it wasn't written well enough that like you knew what was wrong or how she would react. Like, she wasn't doing any childlike
that's
behavior.
True.
It was just very absurd.
Yes.
So that's why it didn't like it. They just didn't really understand the comedy of it.
Right.
And they just thought, oh, just call her Hortense and do this and give her false teeth and we'll do it for it. It's like,
the
no.
The chastity belt gag in
one oh, of the you thought that one. Was funny?
I laughed.
I didn't find that funny.
It was grody.
Yeah. But so they missed beats. They rushed it. And then what was really interesting was that, you know, they find out they've been conned. And then they have the same thing where he comes and he's conning all these people and he brings them to Beaumont-sur-Mer. And then they have another scene after that.
Yes, they added another scene.
Which I'm like, okay, so you rush everything just to put like another cherry on top. Completely useless scene.
Well,
the film should have ended where it was because that gave me nothing.
The audience
all it did was kind of bookmark the gag of like blending into trash, but now with like the Christmas tree from like the end to that.
Uh-huh.
But then it's like, okay, so now I'm just visually seeing what the three of you are like, and now all of a sudden you're best friends and stuff, and okay, Anne Hathaway likes you guys all of a sudden because she was not happy about it before.
Uh-huh.
But like, so it was like unnecessary and stupid.
I agree with you. I thought it was a little unnecessary. However, the audience members I was sitting next to, I they were a little loud and whispering throughout the whole movie.
Oh, were
they loved it. They loved that ending. They're like, oh, because as soon as the it's revealed that three of them are going to start conning together, like I literally heard the guy I was sitting next to, he whispers to I guess his girlfriend, it's just like, oh my god, I want to see this movie. And then they give you that scene and you're like, oh my god, yes. And I was just like, oh, come on, guy, calm down. But
that was funny.
But no, I genuinely like Rebel Wilson's story with like the guy, because I like also the kind of storyline they did with the guy, the Mark.
Yeah.
He was like this tech billionaire, but he didn't really sell the rights properly. So he only has like an X amount of money. So that's why she ends up feeling like sympathy for him.
Yeah.
Anne Hathaway, who just doesn't care. She's just like, I just want you out of here. I'm going to win this bet.
True. Well, okay, so here's something I want. What do you think about this whole Medusa thing?
All right, so I wanted to mention this.
Yeah.
Because it was this thing that was kind of like, kind of thrown in there. It was mentioned once or twice, a reference to, but not really explained. Like, I never got the sense of that there was a person whose code name is Medusa and that she is known as a legendary con artist.
Well, that's true. They Rebel Wilson, I will say this one, they did build that out kind of nicely. Rebel Wilson was constantly saying, it's like, oh, you're Medusa.
Yeah.
Like, right? Like, that was like kind of the running joke in the whole movie, that Rebel Wilson is just like kind of spoiling that twist in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, you're obviously Medusa. And you know, Anne Hathaway's character is always just like, no, I'm not. What are you talking? Even at the very end, when like it's just like, oh, he was your nephew? Or yeah. your grandson?
You're his mom, yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
But I know what you mean. I think the other films, they did a little bit of a better job
at
building up this other character who they don't, it's thrown in the background and yet it's constantly there.
So here's the thing, right? In Dirty Rotten Scoundrels in particular, Michael Caine hears about another con artist coming into his town called the Jackal.
Right.
He meets Steve Martin and he assumes that Steve Martin is the Jackal. And then the whole film happens and then he realizes that this person that they targeted, this young girl, was indeed this brilliant con artist. And it's this gender reversal, gender politic reversal, where it's like, oh my God, you know, how foolish was I to assume that the man was that when this brilliant woman was that? So when I realized that this film was being remade, I was like, how are they going to do that? Because now we're like, you know, we're enlightened. It's like a really great age of feminism.
Oh.
And we're going to turn this around, right? So it's two women conning a man. But like that reveal doesn't, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, I agree with you. That reveal worked less.
Yeah. So I was like, if they would have realized that this man conned them, I think actually a lot of people would be kind of disappointed. Because, like, it's fun to have women conning men.
Uh-huh.
Just, like, based on, like, gender politics and fairness. So, I think they added the Medusa thing to make it seem like, let's throw in the fact that there's a famous Medusa. Yeah, to balance it. Exactly. Because it's like, oh, he's great, but he was taught by this woman.
Right.
But at the same time, that's why I think, and I'm pretty sure that's why they did that, and they threw in that Medusa thing to bring in the balance. But, like Eddie said, it proves that it didn't really work because he didn't really get it or why it was necessary. Because it's also like the jackal could be, it's, you know, genderless. Medusa, that's a woman.
Yes.
So it's like also very clearly when they did that in this film, I was like, wait a minute, then who the fuck is going to be Medusa? It can't right. be this guy. You know, so then that already was like, oh, I see what they're going to try and do. And they have this intention to balance it out. But I think they did it a little flat. Do you think this film needed to be remade in 2019?
That's
with
a
women?
Very good question. Yes. I think this, I don't know if it needed to be made.
The
I'm
intention
glad
of
it, was,
it
made.
Was made. Yeah. But do you think it also like was good?
I liked it. It's a popcorn movie. It's yeah. a movie that I actually would have enjoyed for my usual $5.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Which is why I was so outraged I paid 13, but yeah.
Right. But at the same time, though, it's another movie. It's like a movie that if I see it on Netflix or something mm-hmm. and I hadn't seen it in theaters, I would have watched it once and I would have laughed. I
yeah.
think it's a very enjoyable, it's a good, fun date movie.
Yeah.
But I wish it had a little more depth.
Yeah. Me too.
You know? And I kind of wish I hadn't seen Dirty Rotten Scoundrel because I actually think if I hadn't seen Dirty Rotten Scoundrels first, I actually might have enjoyed this movie a little more.
You know, I like this film and I think this film needed to be remade for those people sitting next to you. I think that the people sitting next to you who go to the movies and probably don't know a lot about their film history and like watch it on a different level than, say, me. I'm not going to say surface level. I don't know how those people watch movies, but I'm going to assume that they're more frequent moviegoers and who don't necessarily question what they see.
Uh-huh.
So for people who go to the movies like that and they're presented in front of them, fierce, powerful, funny, great women, you know, doing these really cool, remarkable things, that's where this movie is needed.
Yeah.
For me, this movie, I wanted it and it didn't give me what I wanted, but, you know, it made me laugh. And I can appreciate it for some things like the acting and all this stuff. I thought that the sound editing actually wasn't very good. Sometimes the additional dialogue was unbelievable. I was like, are you kidding me that it was so poorly done? But that's also as an editor talking.
Are you talking about the, what's that word? ADR?
ADR. Yeah.
Did
you notice that?
Yes.
Yeah. The ADR was so
specifically
bad.
When they're going down the tunnel?
Yes.
Yeah. I caught that too.
I was just like, are you kidding me? But I'm an editor, guys. That's what I do for a living. So, of course, I noticed that.
Guys, we're professionals.
Yeah. So
we work in the industry.
But the opening animation was fantastic, too.
I love that opening intro. Yeah.
That was
actually cute.
That's one thing I wrote down.
Do you want to do a lightning round?
Let's do a lightning round.
Lightning round.
Okay. So, David Niven, Michael Caine, Anne Hathaway.
Okay. So... this is going to be controversial, I think, but I'm going to go probably with Anne Hathaway.
That's not controversial. That's predictable. Sorry.
Is it? How dare you, ma'am? Wow. Shady.
No. Okay. First of all, her fashion for fashion. Yes. Check Anne Hathaway. Some of the things she wore were unbelievable.
Yeah.
In terms of like, bitch knew how to walk downstairs. And when bitch walked down those stairs, she was like, bitch, I'm fine. Like, I was just like, you know how to walk downstairs and I love you for it.
Mm-hmm. Or when she was teaching Rebel to cry.
And that too, yeah. But then I was like, well, that's how you won your Academy Award and now I know how
well,
you
let her
it.
Fucking brag.
But I think in terms of best character, best written character, best laid out character, it would have to be Michael Caine's interpretation of that character. So
yeah, he's for sure a close second.
Yeah.
I would say.
Well, but you even agreed that they just made her into a cold, icy bitch. So for character, you know, like they ruined her. But Anne Hathaway is just she's great.
Anne Hathaway actually... her comedy works so well.
Yeah.
I think is what it is. Like even if they kind of derailed her character in that last act, she was still funny.
True.
For me.
Okay, so Marlon Brando, Steve Martin, Rebel Wilson.
Wanna go with Steve Martin.
I think Steve Martin's a clear winner here. Yeah. He just really did the role well.
He is. He's so good.
He's very good.
He's just so good.
Also, did you notice how the gag of his hand being super glued was so well done in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels? Because you think he's just hanging out there and then it's like, yeah, can you give me some super glue?
That was, yes, yes. That's
and
a good...
they ruined it in The Hustle.
Yeah.
She's just like there, like, oh, I'm stuck here. Like, and the women are gone. Like, they fucked that up. So Steve Martin, we're in agreement. Now for the target, Shirley Jones, Glenn Headey, or Alex Sharp?
Ooh, okay. I almost probably would have thought Alex Sharp, but I could not. All the whole movie, I actually thought it was a kid from Spy Kids.
Mm.
It's not, apparently. Eddie had to correct me all right on my argument.
No, it's not the kid.
The whole time I'm like, yes, it is. It's the kid from Spy Kids. He's grown up now. I actually think it might be him.
Oh.
He was sweet. He was... oh, my God. Did I say the whole cast of the... I picked the whole cast of the new one.
Yeah,
you wow, did. That's
well,
funny.
Except for Steve Martin.
Oh, except for Steve Martin. All right, yeah.
But I'm going to pick the whole cast of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. I think they just really knocked it out of the park. Mm. And I think Glenn Headey as that character really was fantastic.
I didn't care for her character up until like she did the transformation at the end.
Yeah, the transformation's everything.
The transformation is so good. Like, that's a good... Like, her accent that she's working with and like the bad wig she's wearing. Great. I think the character this kid played was a little nicer for me.
Okay.
It felt a little more, it felt interesting, weirdly enough, like a little more fleshed out, kind of. And maybe it's because like it's such a modern story, right? Like the tech billionaire who isn't really a billionaire.
Yeah.
Although he, you know, again, butchered it towards the end, but whatever. It is what it is.
Yeah.
What can you do? But yeah, that's it. Do you think you'll ever fall for a con?
Me? Yeah. I think so.
I've always wondered that too. You know how I mentioned I always wanted to be a con artist, but I've always been afraid. It's like, what if I ever fall for a fucking con?
True.
All right, Nicole. That was a lovely trip down con artist lane.
Beaumont-sur-Mer.
But
now we must catch the train to Portofino.
Yes. Let's ride the Orient Express. Is that what they were on?
Well, let's just do this whole podcast universe where now we're going to get on the Orient
Express. They're all connected.
Yeah.
All aboard.
Oh, my goodness.
Let's find Hercule Poirot and get out of here.
Let's go. He would have solved it. He would have seen through these con artists in a heartbeat.
It's the two gray cells.
Yeah. Okay. So, guys, before we go, though, we just want to remind you, please... Mm-hmm. Rate us, like us on your podcast app.
Yes.
Leave us reviews. They help us out a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Also, be sure to hit us up on social media. Let us know what you thought of this week's episode. We asked you guys some questions. Let us know what you guys, your responses are.
Yes.
You can find us on Instagram. Where can they find us, Nicole?
Remakes, Reboots, Revivals.
And where can they find us on Facebook?
At facebook.com/remakes, reboots, and revivals.
I don't think there's an and for the Facebook.
Oh, Remakes, Reboots, Revivals.
And what is our email address?
FunkyPizza2001@gmail.com
No, it's just Remakes, Reboots, Revivals at gmail.com. Email us. We love hearing from you guys. And you never know. We might read it on air. So
We might.
Sometimes we're a little backlogged, to be totally honest.
Yeah.
We can honestly say that.
Because we got so many emails. So
enough emails. So yeah. But all right, guys. This is fun.
Yeah.
Remember, stay smart out there. Don't get conned.
Yeah, stay smart and don't get conned.
Well, until next time, stay unoriginal.